Today, who is the bigger fool? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, in this week's review, as normal, we'll start in the US, go across to Europe, across to Asia, and end in Australia. And we'll touch on oil and gold and crypto on the way through. This week has been, well, interesting. And Wall Street ended lower on Friday as investors assessed economic data and awaited a potential 50 basis point interest rate hike by the US Federal Reserve at its policy meeting next week. In fact, Wall Street's main indices have fallen this week after logging two straight weekly gains. Weighing heavily on investors are fears of a potential recession next year due to the extended central bank's rate hikes. For the week, the S&P 500 dropped 3.4%, the Dow lost 2.8%, and the Nasdaq shed 4% as US stocks ended that recent run of losses on Thursday after data showed initial jobless claims rose, well, modestly last week. Economists polled by Reuters, however, forecast the US economy will hit a short and shallow recession in the coming year. And the catalyst for the falls on Friday was a stronger than expected US producer price index, which rose slightly more than expected in November amid a jump in the costs of services, despite a moderating trend, with annual inflation at the factory gate posting its smallest increase in 1 to 1.5 years. The US Labor Department said on Friday that the producer price index for final demand increased 0.4% last month, which was above economists' forecasts. And on the 12-month through to November, the PPI rose by 7.4%. Data for October was revised up to show the PPI gaining 0.3% instead of 0.2%, as had been previously reported. Today's data shows that inflation is coming down, but it's lingering and is stickier than most assume, said Anthony Saglini, chief market strategist at MMPrize Financial. And it's worth noting that in December, consumer sentiment improved while inflation expectations eased to a 15-month low, according to the University of Michigan survey, which showed its measure of consumers' one-year inflation expectations fell to 4.6% this month. That's the lowest reading since September 2021, from 4.9% in November. And the survey's five-year inflation outlook was unchanged at 3% in December. Consumer price data for November, due on Tuesday next week, will provide additional clues on the central bank's monetary tightening plans. It's still going to take a bit of time for elevated inflation to get resolved, said David Keller at StockCharts. That, combined with the inverted yield curve and high probabilities of recession being the issue going into next year, I'm expecting further inflationary pressures and further downside for risk assets from here. Future traders are suggesting a 77% chance the Fed will raise interest rates by 50 basis points next week, with a 23% chance of a 75 basis point hike, with those odds actually little changed after Friday's economic data. We think the markets are too sanguine on rates after the first quarter, said Cliff Hodge, chief investment officer at Cornerstone Wealth. We expect Federal Chair Jerome Powell to take a more hawkish tone and for the dots to indicate higher rates for a longer period of time than what is currently being priced in by the futures markets. A hawkish step down, so to say. The week ahead should be a pivotal one for the markets at the end of the year, Oxford economist John Cavanagh said, with decisions from the Fed, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of England. Cavanagh said he expects an aggressive Fed will continue to fuel recession risks. Michael Gregory, deputy chief economist at Bank of Montreal, said he's expecting a 0.5 percentage point increase, which would lift the target range for the Fed funds rate to 4.25% to 4.5%. That's the highest in 15 years. Gregory said he will be particularly focused on the updated economic projections from the Fed next week, reflecting a higher policy rate profile. We're expecting to see slower growth and higher joblessness. but we're also expected to see more stubborn inflation, indicating that the net risks of policy rates rest decidedly on the upside. And by the way, in Canada, the central bank there lifted rates last week. As a result of more hawkish Federal Reserve moves, next week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.91% on Friday, the Nasdaq Composite slipped 0.7%, and the S&P 500 fell 0.74%. Tech stocks ended flat as Apple and Meta platforms ran out of steam. Chip stocks ended lower despite an almost 3% gain in Broadcom after the chipmaker delivered a bright outlook on revenue following better than expected results. Netflix climbed more than 3%, adding to its recent gains after Wells Fargo upgraded the stock to overweight from equal weight, and Netflix is actually on quite a few top pick lists at the moment. DocuSigns reported better than expected quarterly results, driven by stronger than expected growth in billings, sending its shares more than 12% higher. This quarter was a step in the right direction for DocuSign, Wedbush said, but added that there was still lots of ground to make up to meet its long-term targets and to regain the street's confidence with a more difficult operating environment on the horizon. Energy, however, was the biggest drag on the market, falling more than 2% as oil prices settled lower to wrap up their worst week since March. Oil prices fell 10% actually over the week, driven by an increase in Russian oil supply ahead of the EU embargo and doubts about the effectiveness of the price cap. In fact, Bloomberg's estimated that Russian oil production reached an 8-month high in November. Schlumberger and Halliburton were down about 5%, while Devon Energy Corporation slipped 4%. Oil prices settled lower in volatile trading on Friday, with both benchmarks recording their biggest weekly declines in months, as growing recession fears negated any supply woes after weak economic data from China, Europe, and the US. US West Texas Intermediate crude settled at $71.50 a barrel, a new low for 2022, and Brent crude settled lower at $76.82 per barrel. Any concerns about supply are secondary to worries about the economy, the Mizzou analyst Robert Yeager said. Oil prices had found some support and risen more than 1% earlier in the session after Russian President Vladimir Putin said the world's biggest energy exporter could cut output in response to a price cap on its crude oil exports. However, a slightly higher than expected rise in the US producer prices in November and news of a partial reset on the Keystone pipeline undid those gains and pushed the benchmarks more than a dollar lower. Keystone shut earlier this week after a 14,000 barrel oil leak in Kansas. Both crude benchmarks posted weekly losses of around 10% each. It was the biggest weekly decline since April for the US WTI futures and since early August for Brent, having previously fallen to their weakest level since December 2021. Both Yeager and Walter Zinnemann, chief technical analyst at ICAP, warned that if US crude falls below $70 a barrel, it could enter a free fall and hit the low 60s range over the upcoming sessions. The market structure for WTI contracts switched to trade in contango over the next year for the first time since November 2020, with contracts for near-term delivery cheaper than the 1 year later. Brent contracts have also switched to trade in contango over the next 6 months. A market in contango suggests less worry about the current supply situation due to weakened demand and encourages traders to put barrels into storage. Elsewhere, gold futures rose 0.44% to 1,808, while the dollar index lifted slightly to 104.93 and the euro-US dollar traded at 1.0534. European stock markets edged lower in nervous trading on Friday as investors looked at the latest US inflation data amid growing recession worries. But in fact, the DAX in Germany rose 0.74%, while the CAC 40 in France traded up 0.46%, and the FTSE 100 in the UK rose just a tad to 7,476. Spanish industrial production rose 2.5% in the year to October. That's a drop from the 3.6% growth in the prior month. And the big news in the corporate sector was Credit Suisse, whose stocks rose 1.9% after the embattled Swiss lender announced late on Thursday that it had raised 2.24 billion Swiss francs as a result of a capital raise, in addition to the 1.8 billion raised from an earlier placing of stock with a group of institutional investors led by Saudi National Bank. This two-stage capital increase gives the CEO the funds needed to proceed with the complicated restructuring plan that includes, among other things, the spin-off of the investment division. According to a document filed with the Swiss Stock Exchange, as of December the 8th, the Riyadh-based bank owns 12.7% of Credit Suisse Capital, which is followed by another Gulf Arab entity, Qatar Holdings, directly controlled by the National Sovereign Wealth Fund, Qatar Investment Authority, with 5.03%. And as a reminder, the Saudi Arabian bank is more than 37% owned by the public investment fund, Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, which, according to a Wall Street Journal rumour, has also its eyes on CS First Boston, the new investment bank of Credit Suisse, created by a spin-off. Prince Mohammed is reportedly considering an investment of around $500 million in the new merchant bank, which could be joined by banker Bob Diamond's Atlas Merchant Capital. It is an interference that could create some belly aching in the European banking system, but for now has assured the Swiss bank that it can go ahead with operations, even if, as Credit Suisse chairman Axel Lehmann said, it will take about 2 years for CS First Boston to become fully independent, with analysts predicting a long and complex process. On the cost side, the bank's restructuring, though, is proceeding. As confirmed by the institution itself, the measures on expense reductions initiated as at December the 8th represented 80% of the cost-based reduction target for 2023, and this amounted to about 1.2 billion Swiss francs. The success of the capital raise marks the end of a downturn run for the bank's stock that lasted 13 consecutive sessions and brought the market valuation down to less than $12.7 billion, equal to the price of 2.99 Swiss francs per share, compared to 6.22 Swiss francs per share 6 months ago, when the shares closed at 3.14 in Switzerland. The European Central Bank will also likely lift its deposit rate by 50 basis points next week to 2%, even as the Eurozone economy is believed to already to be in a recession, even as the European winter sets in, putting yet more pressure on energy prices. Now, most Asian stock markets rebounded from recent losses on Friday, ahead of those key US inflation statistics, although fears of a global recession and rising interest rates put most regional exchanges on course for weekly losses. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index was the best performer on the day, rising 2.32% amid growing bets that the city's government will follow Beijing in scaling back anti-COVID measures. The Hang Seng also vastly outperformed its Asian peers for a second consecutive week, rallying nearly 6%. China's Shanghai Composite added 1.4% this week as China scaled back several COVID-related movement curbs and testing mandates. It was up 0.3% on Friday to 3,203.95. The move ramped up hopes over a broader reopening in the world's second largest economy as it faces increasing public unrest and worsening economic conditions. But recent economic readings show that the country has a long road to recovery. China's inflation shrank further in November as overall business activity contracted. Other Asian exchanges rose. Japan's Nikkei 225 added 1.18%, while the South Korean Kospi rose 0.76%, although technology-heavy markets in Asia were the worst performers this week as the sector was battered by warnings of a potential US recession in 2023. The Kospi and Taiwan-weighted indices shed about 2% each this week. Australian shares closed firmer on Friday, buoyed by miners that benefited from stronger iron ore prices as China loosened their COVID-19 restrictions, fueling hopes for revived demand. shares in BlueScope Steel prove resilient after a federal court judge found the company and one of its former executives, Jason Ellis, tried to engage in cartel conduct and price fixing in the supply of flat steel products. BlueScope closed 0.4% higher at $18.22. The S&P ASX 200 index advanced 0.5% or 37 points on Friday to 7,213, following three sessions of losses. And the All Ordinaries also rose 0.5% to 7,403.90. The main index, however, ended the week 1.7% lower and well away from a six-month top touched earlier this month. Miners led the gains, helped by stronger iron ore prices, as the loosening of strict COVID-19 restrictions fueled hopes for a revival in demand. Iron ore futures in Singapore were up 1.89% to 111.28 on the back of the China news. A weaker US dollar and optimism over a China reopening supported sentiment, as did positive developments in China's troubled property sector, said Daniel Haynes, a senior commodity strategist at ANZ. BHP Group jumped 2.7% to 47.48. Fortescue Metals powered up 2.8% to 21.39, and Rio Tinto advanced 2.3% to 117.16. Shares in lithium miners, however, slumped following Goldman Sachs' negative outlook for the metal. Alcum shares fell 1.4%, Pilbara Minerals shed 0.2%, and Liontown eased 0.3%. Core Lithium shaved 0.4%, further undermined by the Goldman Sachs sell rating. Shares in Healius ended flat at $2.88. The company agreed to sell Montserrat Day Hospitals for $139 million and promoted Maxine Jacquet as its new CEO after Malcolm Parmeter stepped down. Beach Energy stock gained 0.9% to $1.66 after surrendering in the takeover race for Warrego Energy and opted to focus instead on developing existing onshore gas assets in the Perth Basin. Warrego shares skidded 3.3% on the news. Gina Reinhart's Hancock Prospecting is now poised to secure Warrego's acquisition, unless, of course, another bidder emerges. Nitro Software shares rallied 3.4% to $2.13 after the company said it would review a sweetening bid from suitor Potentia at $2 a share. Pinnacle Investment Management Group retreated 3.7% to $8.43 after warning its performance fee income would drop sharply in the first half of the financial year, and shares in the Star Entertainment Group edged up 0.4% before being placed on trading halt ahead of a court decision. The company was fined $100 million by the Queensland government. Its Brisbane and Gold Coast casinos will stay open under the supervision of a special manager. Among the banks, CBA was down to 104.98, ANZ was up to 23.64, NAB was up to $30.19, and Westpac was up 0.64% to 23.44, but Macquarie was down a further 1.82% to 168.04. The Aussie traded up 0.41% against the US dollar to 67.96, and it was 55.44 against the pound. In fact, a return to risk-on sentiment saw short sellers throw in the towel in November as the Australian share market rallied to its highest level in 6 months, fueled by hopes of China reopening and a Federal Reserve pivot. Median short interest levels in the S&P ASX 300 index declined sharply to 1.7% by the end of November, tumbling from a four-year peak of around 1.9% as the local market clawed back its losses. So we wonder, who is the greater fool? Credit Suisse equity and macro strategist Ye Ying Dong said optimism that China may relax its strict virus controls and hopes the US central bank might slow the pace of monetary tightening pushed hedge funds to back off. The decline in short interest activity coincided with a very strong month of returns for the ASX 300, gaining 6.1%, he said. It's difficult to maintain short positions when you have a strong risk-on environment. Jun Beilu Portfolio manager of the Long Short Tribeca Alpha Plus strategy said short sellers are still trying to interpret a seismic shift in equity markets as the winning short technology trade fades and they rotate back into quality growth names. In those circumstances, you see hedge funds becoming a bit more cautious around turning points in the market, reducing their exposure before any significant trends form, she said. Large short exposures have been brought back over the past few months because hedge funds have been under a lot of pressure. And finally, Bitcoin US dollar dipped to a level closer to 17,000 US after passing that level overnight on Thursday, reacting to the US producer price index. And Ether followed the same pattern, down 1.53% to 1,265. The Bitcoin Aussie cross was down a little by 0.72% to 25,228. It's a bit of an overreaction towards PPI, which has been dropping significantly from last month, but less than expected. Michelle van der Poppe, founder and CEO of trading firm 8, said CPI next week is the big trigger, just like it was earlier this month, he added. CPI could be a seminal point, trading firm QCP Capital continued, as if it were to continue its downward trend, markets may get an even stronger conviction over low inflation, greeting the new year. The Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee meeting in a few days' time, where policymakers decide on interest rate hikes, could add fuel to the fire. Tuesday's CPI will be yet another important indicator, this time because the market has set up to be an epic two-month short squeeze rally, QCP wrote in a market update. But to add to all the market intrigue, a report from the Bank for International Settlements showed that they've lost track of around $80 trillion US dollars of stuff. The BIS's economists have recently delved into the entrails of the bank's foreign exchange survey to track the trend in dollar swaps, the derivatives that enable investors to exchange dollars for other currencies for a specific period before swapping them back. And as the latest BIS quarterly report notes, forward dollar payment obligations, quote, do not appear on balance sheets and are missing in standard debt statistics because they are not classified as a loan in accounting systems. They are off balance sheets. In other words, it's a black hole. And that hole is astonishingly big. The BIS detective work suggests that there's around $80 trillion worth plus in outstanding obligations to pay US dollars in foreign exchange swaps or forwards and currency swaps. This has doubled in the past decade with a $5 trillion churn every single day. Some $39 trillion of this involve non-American banks, another $26 trillion non-American non-bank entities such as hedge funds and insurance companies. Moreover, the non-bank category has grown rapidly, dwarfing on-balance sheet risk, and is often associated with maturity mismatches. While there may be no signs of current stress, history shows that foreign exchange swap markets are vulnerable to funding squeezes, the BIS said. And this is because when shocks hit, investors worry about how to repay those dollar obligations, creating wild price gyrations. And while the Federal Reserve has quelled panic in the past by letting other central banks supply dollars, the black hole means that the dollar swaps market was backstopped in 2008 and 2020 by central banks acting on little information about who owned the debt. The BIS is now quite sensibly begging central bankers to plug the data gap. But as the FT reports, one dirty secret of global finance is that this $80 trillion black hole is far from being the only place where we need more sunlight. The sphere of private credit is also startlingly murky. So is the behavior of the Chinese credit cycle, as a new paper from the Fed notes. This matters because Chinese credit conditions have big spillover implications for global asset markets, including the dollar-based one. But another area of surprising data fog is treasuries, which, like dollar swaps, underpin so much of the financial system. During the dramatic market turmoil of 2020, it became clear that secondary market trading structures have big vulnerabilities that were not understood or reported before. And while the Securities and Exchange Commission and the US Treasury is trying to fix this, progress is slow. The primary market, meanwhile, has its own transparency problems, as the economists Tobovia and Warnock recently argued. Public data shows overall bids on bond auctions and the broad patterns of foreign purchases, but it does not reveal which buyers are buying, which bonds, or their price sensitivity. That matters, actually, they argue. Given the US government's $18 trillion negative foreign asset position, it needs to know which investors will step in and buy treasuries against the looming specter of higher treasury yields, while at the same time the Federal Reserve is reducing its treasury portfolio. So the economists have scoured private data sources and concluded that while non-Americans own about half of all treasuries, their behavior is poorly understood. To cite one example, while official statistics claim that foreign private investors are buying around $3.5 trillion more treasuries each year than foreign governments between 2005 and 2019, they think the latter actually bought around $1 trillion more than the former. That's important, since foreign government purchases have recently slowed and they have acted in a strikingly price inelastic way before, with much shorter portfolio durations than private investors, in that the digitalization of private data is making it easier to do this type of detective work. Better still, after 2008 global financial crisis, the US Treasury created the Office of Financial Research, which is supposed to take a holistic view of markets. But the bad news is that the OFR has faced calls to cut its budget, and it cannot hope to get better data on dollar swaps or treasuries without help from central banks. So, the question is, will the American government, amongst others, treat the revelations about this $80 trillion black hole as a wake-up call? After all, if there ever was a moment when central bankers needed to understand the real vulnerabilities arising from dollar-linked debt, it is when the world faces geopolitical risks, economic pain, and political challenges to the supremacy of the dollar. And that, of course, is precisely what 2023 could bring. Which takes me back to my question then, who is the greater fool? There are plenty of them around, and unfortunately, many of them are in leadership positions within the financial infrastructure, central banks, and the like. Plus, of course, the traders who are trying to make money and take positions. So I think retail investors need to understand that they are second-class citizens at best, and trying to guess where the markets are going at the moment is, well, nigh impossible. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.